I'd been in it, after all, for less than a day. So much to know. I must slowly grow accustomed to its ways. The old world was now nothing more than a freak construct in my head, and in my head alone. A possibility that never happened, a turning never taken, the subject for a horror novel. Auschwitz, Birkenau, Treblinka, Bergen-Belsen, Ravensbrück, Buchenwald, Sobibor. What were they now? Small towns in Poland and Germany. Happy, silly little towns whose names were washed clean of sin and blame. Have you ever visited the charming village of Dachau in Germany? Well worth a stop on the tourist route. Very handy for the grand old city of Munich. I would especially recommend the Hotel Adler. For those on a tour of Saxony and the north, don't forget, after exploring Hanover, that the little hamlet of Bergen-Belsen offers the traveller old-world charm blended with modern convenience. I giggled and hugged myself inside. My own fate, marooned in a new history, was incidental. No one would ever believe what I had done, or from what hellish historical roots I had emerged. How could they? Doctors would cluster about me and shake their heads at my unique style of amnesia, a strain of memory loss that took the form of an accent change, for the Lord's sake, an article or two perhaps in journals of neuropathology, maybe even an essay by Oliver Sacks in his next collection of psychological anecdotes, The American Who Woke Up English, or A Hampshire Limey in the Court of Connecticut Yankees. In time, my accent would become American, and I would learn my history. What I had done would go unknown and unacknowledged. I imagined a scenario in Cambridge in the bad old world. A man comes up to me and says, "Revere me. I stopped Peter Popper from being born." "Peter Popper?" I say. "Who the hell is he?" "Ha!" this man replies. "Exactly. He was born in 1900 and caused death, disaster, cruelty and horror. He sent the century hurtling into an apocalypse of internecine strife and bestiality beyond imagining." "He did?" "Yup. And I have just returned from stopping him from being born. Thanks to me, London is still standing. Peter Popper levelled it with a bomb in 1950. I am the saviour of the century." Well, I mean to say, how would anyone react to talk like that? A pat on the head, some loose change, and a hasty retreat. No, I should have to hug to myself and myself alone the knowledge of what I had achieved. Steve, leading me once more through the campus, smiled at my exuberance. "Guess that sleep did you good, right?" "You can say that again. My God, this place is beautiful." We walked on in silence, winding through lawns and courts, till we reached a large stone building on the edge of campus. Three young men were standing idly at the doorway, watching our approach. "Oh, gosh," said Steve, under his breath. "What is it?" "It's just the guys."
"The guys?"
"Yeah, Scott, Todd and Ronnie. They were with us last night."
The taller of them pushed himself off the wall against which he had been leaning and came towards me, extending a hand.
"Well, hello," he said in an excruciating English accent. "How are you, old bean, old crumpet?"
"Beat it, Todd," said Steve.
"Hello," I said. "So you're Todd?"
"That's right, my chap. I'm Todd," he enunciated the short English O, "and this is Scott, and this is Ronnie."
"Well," I said, attempting American, "hi there, Todd, Scott, Ronnie."
They laughed, but with awkward uncertainty.
"I mean, like, this is a gag, Mikey, right?" said Scott.
"Well, actually, I'm afraid not," I said. "I expect Steve has told you all about it. I woke up this morning thinking I was English. I've been unable to remember much about myself. Weird, I know, but true."
"Yeah?"
"Mm-hmm."
"No shit," said Ronnie. "You trying to say you don't remember no $100 I lent you last week?"
"Asshole," said Steve, as they laughed at my discomfiture. "Come on, guys, you said you'd leave us alone."
"Hey," said Scott. "We roomed with this goofball for a whole fucking year. We got as much right as you to hang out with him now he's nuts."
"Only maybe we don't have the same desire to be close to him, Burns. You know what I'm saying?"
"Look," I said, alarmed at Steve's embarrassment, "I know it must seem really crazy to you. It's all probably down to a bang on the head. My parents are English, so maybe that's got something to do with it."
Scott thumped me on the back. "We're with you, buddy. Just don't expect me to ever buy you any more vodka again. Ever. You got that? Give 'em hell, Mikey."
Steve led me through them towards a door.
"Just so long as you haven't forgotten how to pitch your slider," said Ronnie as we went in.
Jesus, I thought to myself. Baseball? I don't know the first thing about baseball. And philosophy. I'm supposed to be majoring in philosophy. There are embarrassments ahead.
"And don't let them stick no electrodes in you now, you hear?"
I almost laughed out loud when I came face to face with Simon Taylor. The sign on his door read Professor S. R. St. C. Taylor. And the bright outer office, where his secretary sat in front of a computer, had led me to expect the kind of air-conditioned, relaxed, chino shorts, high-tech and hi-there atmosphere that seemed to prevail around most of the campus.
"Professor Taylor is expecting you,"
the secretary had said, indicating for me and Steve to be seated.
"Would you like some water?"
"Thanks," I said. The secretary nodded and turned back to her computer. I looked at her in some confusion until Steve nudged me in the ribs and pointed at a large, upturned flagon of water in the corner.
"Oh," I said, getting up.
"Right, of course." Next to the water dispenser was a tube of conical paper cups.
"Cool,"
I said. "I've seen these so many times in movies. Edward G. Robinson, you know, you pour yourself a cup of water, there's a great rumbling of air bubbles in the tank, and then you have to drink the water down in one, screw up the paper cone and toss it in a bin. I mean, you can't rest one of these cups on the table, can you?"
The secretary stared at me, and Steve shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"Just drink the water, Mikey," he said.
"Oh, right, yes. For you?"
Steve shook his head and settled back to stare at the opposite wall.
I enjoyed my drink of ice-cold water, joined him on the sofa, and together we inspected a framed poster of Vermeer's Lute Player.
After about 10 minutes, the door to Taylor's office opened, and the man himself appeared. That is when I almost laughed out loud. He was at least 6'5", wearing a linen three-piece suit, a striped college tie, and an Alastair Sim air of baffled surprise. There was a briar pipe clamped between his yellow teeth, and above it a thin strip of Ronald Coleman moustache. His whole demeanour stank of some gin-soaked British club in Kuala Lumpur, or an adulterous Graham Greene outpost in colonial Africa.
"Ah, gentlemen, and which one of you is Michael Young?"
Suppressing a grin, I raised a tentative hand and rose. He looked at me and nodded briskly.
"And you must be Stephen Burns, young man."
"Yes, sir," said Steve.
"Very good, very good. I wonder if you would be kind enough to hang on here for a while. I may ask you to come and join us later."
"No problem, sir."
"Perhaps Virginia might be good enough to hunt up a cup of coffee or a soda for you. Do help yourself to magazines and so forth. Good, good. So if you'd like to come in, Mr. Young, we can have a bit of an old chat."
Taylor held open the door from the top, so I stepped under his arm and into the office, casting a rueful look at Steve over my shoulder.
"Why don't you sit over there, old man?"
The office walls were panelled in dark wood, with a desk in front of the main window. A dimpled leather Chesterfield ran along one wall, and it was at this that Taylor pointed.
"Do feel free to smoke. You won't mind my old pipe, I hope."
I shook my head and felt for the pack in my shorts. As he leaned forward to light a squashed lucky, I couldn't help gasping out in surprise.
St. Matthew's!
I'm sorry?
That tie! You're a St. Matthew's man!
He nodded gently and shook out his match.
I have that honour.
He pulled the chair from in front of his desk and set it in front of the sofa, settling into it slowly.
That's not a tie many here recognise. Tell me what you know about the place.
While I prepared an answer, he reached out a long hand and picked up a buff file from the desk and opened it. I was presented with a problem. There was no point that I could see in my revealing all that I knew about Cambridge and England. So far as my record would show him, I was born and brought up in the United States. Any knowledge of the strange details of a collegiate university would be most unusual in an untravelled American. The natural show-off in me, however, wanted desperately to baffle him with my intimate understanding of all things English. It would be so hard for him to explain. Perhaps it would force him to believe in astral projection and out-of-body experiences. I was beginning to understand that I could have fun and power in this new world.
Well, I said, it's a Cambridge college, isn't it?
You ever visited Cambridge, Michael?
Not exactly, but, you know, I'm interested in English things, my parents and all, so I've read quite a lot.
You told Dr. Ballinger that you actually lived in Cambridge, I understand. Cambridge, England, and St. Matthew's was the college you mentioned.
Ah, I screwed up my face. You see, I woke up really confused this morning. I couldn't remember anything. Anything at all.
You could remember how to speak.
Well, yes, obviously.
Obviously?
Well, I mean, isn't that usual with amnesia?
He shrugged his shoulders.
You tell me, young fellow.
We allowed a pause to develop. It seemed to me that it was a battle of wills. Taylor lost.
Tell me, then, he said, what you know about Cambridge, generally. Everything that comes to mind.
Well, it's the second oldest university in England, after Oxford, of course. It's made up of colleges, names like Trinity, King's, St. John's, St. Catherine's, St. Matthew's, Christ's, Queen's, Magdalen Keys, Jesus, that kind of thing.
Spell Magdalen for me.
I cursed myself and did so.
Good. Now spell Keys.
Oh, well, I thought, in for a penny. Taylor made a note on a pad.
And yet you knew they were pronounced Magdalen and Keys, didn't you?
Well, as I say, I've read a lot about them.
I wonder which books. Do you remember?
Not really, no. Just books.
I see. And what about Princeton? What do you know about Princeton?
I ransacked my mind feverishly for every nugget Steve had disgorged that morning when we'd walked through the campus.
Nassau Hall, I said, named after Prince William of Orange Nassau, though it could have been named after someone called Belcher, but he was too modest.
Washington came there and signed the Treaty of Independence. No, that was Philadelphia, wasn't it?
Well, Washington did come here, and it was the capital of the Union for a time. We are allowed to fly the flag at night,
something like that. There's a gate you shouldn't go through until you've graduated. The west end of campus is known as the slums.
Oh, you know, lots of stuff. Wawa, Minimart, sophomores, you know.
I gestured airily.
Where's Rockefeller College? Dickinson Hall? The Tower?
I gulped.
Excuse me?
And why, I wonder, did you say that Nassau Hall was named after Prince William of Orange Nassau and might have been named after Jonathan Belcher?
Well, isn't it true?
Yes, but you're American, aren't you?
That's right, I said. Sure. I've just gotten this silly accent in my head at the moment, but it's going all the time. I can feel it.
But you see, an American would never say that something was named after someone, would they? They would say it was named for them.
They would?
It's one of those slight little differences. Everyone knows about sidewalks and pavements, flashlights and torches, drapes and curtains, but named after and named for, it's very extraordinary that your change of accent should also include so precise a change of idiom, don't you think? I spread my hands. I guess it's on account of my parents, I said. I mean, they're English after all. I probably picked it up from them, right? Yes, he said doubtfully. They've been here a long time, however, and you were at high school and prep school in America, weren't you? I sat dumbly, wondering where all this might lead. So let's talk about your parents then, shall we? I looked at the carpet. Sure, I said. What do you want to know? Taylor stood up and started to pace the room, fruitlessly lighting and relighting his pipe as he talked. You know, this is all very peculiar, old chap. You started littering the conversation with Americanisms like I guess and gotten. Now you come up with sure, complete with a hard American R. You went to great lengths to persuade Dr. Ballinger that you were 100% British, as English as the White Cliffs of Dover, raised in Hampshire. And now you seem to be trying to convince me that you're as American as apple pie and that your proper accent is returning as mysteriously as it disappeared. Are you saying you don't believe me? I'm just trying to understand, old fellow. It all seems just a trifle inconsistent, doesn't it? Much better we have the truth, don't you think? What is this, a police interrogation? I mean, damn it, I've met people here who know me. I've seen my driving licence. Fuck it, my driver's licence. My rooms in Henry Hall, credit cards, the works. I woke up with a bump on my head and a weird accent. That's all there is to it. I thought the idea was that you and everyone else told me the truth. I'm the one with the fucked memory. All I want is to be able to get on with my life. That's all you want? To forget this ever happened? Get on with your life and finish your tripos? Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what I'm here for, isn't it? And what are you reading? Philosophy. Well, now you see, I'm really puzzled. No university in the world except Cambridge uses the word tripos to describe a degree course. And we at Princeton certainly do not use the word read to mean study. It's all very difficult to understand. Well, bully for you. You've got a case study that can make your reputation. What's the problem? Problem, old chap, is that none of this makes sense. So you think I'm lying? You think I'm trying it on? If so, great, yes, you're absolutely right. It's all a con, a gag, a jape, a rag, whatever the right word is. I've done it for a bet. I'm all better now. I'm as American as apple pie. You're darn tooting, partner. I'm a mean motherfucker American, and I think, if it's all the same to you, I'll be a-moseying along now a piece, thank ye kindly for your time, good sir. Dear me, said Taylor, eyebrows raised once more in full Alistair Sim astonishment. And if it comes to peculiar, I added, where the hell do you get off with all this old chap, old fellow, poker up the arse business, eh? No real Englishman has talked like that for 30 years. You sound like a strangulated version of Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove. I beg your pardon? Never mind, I said. You won't have the faintest idea what I'm talking about. I don't suppose you've heard of Peter Sellers, have you? I could tell by his blank expression that he had not. I suddenly realised that there might now be whole swathes of movies that never existed. Movie actors whom the war and circumstance had pushed into stardom in my world, but were unknown here. Strangelove, The Longest Day, good Lord, Casablanca. There was no Casablanca. But then think of all the new movies from this world made in the last 50 years that I could catch up on. Christ, I could make a fortune. I could write Casablanca. Damn it, I knew it nearly word for word, frame for frame. The Third Man, I could write that too. Stalag 17, The Great Escape, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Jesus!
Taylor had stopped pacing the room and was once more seated in front of me, swinging his legs open and closed so that I could see the wrinkled, sweat-stained crotch of his linen trousers.
"Now listen to me, Michael. I'm going to be absolutely straight with you. Fair enough?"
I pushed the dreams of screenplay glory from my mind and nodded cautiously.
"I can't pretend to you that I understand exactly what is going on inside your head. Hypnosis is one possibility, of course. Self-hypnosis, another.
Are you suggesting that
I'm merely running through the possibilities, old chap. Someone may have hypnotized you, perhaps for a joke, perhaps for less savoury reasons. It may be that you have done this to yourself, accidentally or deliberately. It's very hard to tell. It may even be that you are not who you say you are."
"What?"
"There are, of course, various tests that we could undertake.
Surely it's just the result of a bump on the head. I mean, that happens, doesn't it?"
"Not in my experience, Michael, no. I think the best thing for us to do is to keep you under observation for a while."
"But I feel fine. It's wearing off. I can feel it."
"I don't necessarily mean confining you to bed. If you would agree to submit to some tests over the next few days, I think I can guarantee that you will be allowed to remain at liberty. It may be better if you handed in your driver's license, however. We wouldn't want you wandering off. After all, I'm sure you can understand the implications of all this."
"Implications?" I said, baffled to hell. "What implications?"
"It might be a good idea if we were in touch with your parents. You haven't telephoned them yourself."
"I don't even know their..." I began, then stopped myself. "That's to say, I don't even know they're at home at the moment," I said. "I mean, they're probably at work. I didn't want to worry them."
"Nonetheless, I'm sure someone will be in touch. Now, if you wouldn't mind waiting outside, I'd like a word with Mr. Burns."
I stopped myself just in time from asking who the creosoted fuck Mr. Burns might be, realizing he meant Steve, and walked dazed to the door, Taylor's long arm around my shoulder and my driver's license in his hand. Arrangements were made that the very next morning I would report to the Faculty of Psychology's laboratories for testing. Meanwhile, Steve was lumbered with me once more. He seemed subdued on the way back through the campus. "What did he say to you?" I asked.
"Oh, nothing," he replied. "Just asked me things, you know, how long I'd known you, stuff like that."
"This is a real bore for you, isn't it?" I said. "You know, if you want to leave me alone, I'm sure I'll be fine."
"Can't do it, Mikey. You'll get lost, and it'd be my fault. Besides," he added tactfully, "it wouldn't be fair. You need someone."
I considered this. "Thanks," I said. "I know I keep thanking you, but thanks anyway." He shrugged. "What did Taylor mean, though," I asked, "when he said that there were implications to all this?"
Steve shook his head resolutely. "What say we talk about something else?"
I wanted to ask him so many things. I wanted to know about history. I wanted to know everything there was to know about the history of the last 60 years, 63 years, European history since 1933. I wanted to know who the movie stars were, the rock stars, the president, damn it, the president, the prime minister, everything. I realized such questions would freak him out, so I stilled my tongue. I would slip away later and find a library. Firstly, I felt I owed him something. "Hey, how about this?" I offered. "How about we slide over to the barrister and alchemist and have ourselves a drink?"
"Alchemist and barrister," he corrected mechanically.
Yeah, whatever. I am not saying get hammered or anything. You never know, a little alcohol and I may just click out of it all and be my old self again."
"Okay," he agreed, "but easy on the vodka."
"Easy on the vodka," I promised, thinking of Jane and May Week parties. The alchemist and barrister was low and dark and inviting inside.
The barman there seemed to know me and winked with the distant friendliness one gets to recognise in those who work in university towns. Students are all jerks, the wink seemed to say, but you spend money and we know how to look as if we think you're cool and interesting. Steve and I sat outside drinking pleasant English-style beer under a long canvas awning, watching people walk by. At the table next to us, two men in plaid, short-sleeved shirts were looking at a map and arguing over walks. I suppose you get a lot of tourists coming here. Steve shrugged. A lot for New Jersey, I guess. Those two might see the map better if they took off their dark glasses, I said, blowing out a contented cloud of tobacco smoke. But I suppose tourists are tourists everywhere. Steve nodded distractedly and took a sip of beer. You'll think I'm mad, I know, I said, but I'm supremely happy at the moment. Yeah? Steve sounded surprised. How come? You wouldn't understand if I told you. Try me. I'm happy because when I asked you earlier, you told me that you'd never heard of Adolf Hitler. That made you happy? You can have no idea what that means. You've never heard the names Hitler or Schickelgruber or Pölzl. You've never heard of Brunau. You've never... Brunau? Brunau am Inn, Upper Austria. It's not even a name to you. And that makes me the happiest man alive. Well, that's Jake for you. You've never heard of Auschwitz or Dachau, I bubbled. You've never heard of the Nazi party. You've never heard of... Whoa, whoa, said Steve. OK, so I'm not like Mr. Knowledge. But what do you mean I've never heard of the Nazi party? Well, you haven't, have you? Are you nuts? I stared at him. You can't have done. It's impossible. Oh, sure, said Steve, wiping froth from his lips. And I've never heard of Gloder and Goebbels and Himmler and Frick, right? Hey, look out! Steve grabbed my wrist to straighten the bottle in my hand. A fizzing lake spread on the table between us, and over the edge flowed drop after drop of dark, cold beer.
Political History. Party Animals. The Sternica Brewery? Gloder repeated, striving to keep the contemptuous disbelief from his voice. Meyer smiled. This is Munich, Rudy. Everything that happens in Munich has something to do with beer, you know that. Hoffmann's 3,000 radicals met in the Leuvenbräu. Levinet began his April Revolution in a beer hall. The unemployed Augsburg scum met in the Kindle Keller. The last of the Jew Bolsheviks were shot in a beer hall. It is only fitting, after all. The politics of this city run on beer, just as the war ran on petrol. And why should I spend a hot evening listening to yet another gathering of crankish professors and crazed thulists? Rudy... My department is short of men I can trust. I need reliable Vertrauensmänner, spokesmen, observers and organisers who can talk sense to all these groups and spot the dangerous ones. Only last week, there was an ex-corporal whose dependability I could have sworn to. Karl Lentz, Iron Cross with oak leaf, impeccable references from his brigade major. I needed a man to go to Lechfeld, which we believed to be bolshevistically and spartacistically contaminated. Don't scowl. That's the current jargon, not my fault. So I sent this Lentz as part of an Aufklärungskommando to speak about the terms and explain the army's view on political groupings. Turns out he was secretly some sort of Red himself. Lauterbach tells me he persuaded half the people gathered there that Lenin was a better bet than Weimar. You see the kind of thing I'm up against. Gloder put up a protesting hand. All right, I'll go. I shan't promise to enjoy myself, but I'll go. Find out who these people are. Don't address them or make them feel they're being spied on. Just appraise them for me. Find out what makes them tick, So Rudy found himself later that evening strolling along the Promenadestrasse and whistling to himself. He glanced amusedly at the slogans and drawings on the walls as he passed. Rache! Yes, thought Rudy. Revenge! How politically acute! How mature! Denkt an Graf Arcovalli, ein deutscher Held. Rudy looked around him to the other side of the street and recalled that this had been the very spot where Count Arcovalli had drawn his pistol and shot the Jew communist Kurt Eisner dead with two bullets to the head. A cold day in February it had been, more snow on the ground than had been seen in Munich for decades. Rudy had been standing not far away and was nearly struck himself by one of the three retaliatory shots fired at Arcovalli by Eisner's bodyguard. Then he had found himself placed in the laughably ironic situation of being forced to help Eisner's Jewish secretary keep at bay a band of Spartacists and assorted red scum who wanted to beat the wounded Arcovalli to death there and then. Rudy had travelled with the dying count in a battered police van to a surgeon, another Jew, who had managed to keep the patient alive long enough to deliver his rambling speech of self-justification. Eisner was the gravedigger of Germany. I hated and despised him with all my heart, Arcovalli had spluttered. Keep fighting the fight for the Deutsche Volk, Gloder. The Fatherland needs men like us. Rudy had patted the dying man's hand and uttered a string of noble Teutonic nothings to comfort him. He only knew the man slightly. They were both highly decorated war heroes, the grand ribbons on whose fraying greatcoats were good for free beers in a now rapidly decreasing number of beer cellars around Bavaria. The count had done his glorious deeds on the Russian front, Rudy in Flanders. Rudy never liked him, however. He was one of those more German than the German Austrians who dripped with a sickly brand of mystical pan-Germanism that Rudy found distasteful, like an overgenerous helping of Viennese Sachertorte. Arcovalli had never overcome the bitter humiliation of being refused membership of the Thule Society on account of his mother being Jewish, a circumstance that amused Rudy hugely. The Thules had now conveniently forgotten this, however, and Arcovalli was just one more fading martyred bloom in the garden of ultra-rightist, anti-Semitic nationalist remembrance. The Volkisch groups, the Thules, the Germanen Orden, and three dozen other frenzied groups, each claiming that their infinitesimal variations in nuance and emphasis amounted to major planks of doctrinal difference. My God, it made the Tower of Babel look like an Esperanto conference. Rudy walked past another message, painted in bright red letters, 2 meters high. Judentod beseitigt, Deutschlands not. Well, maybe. Just maybe. It seemed to Rudy, however, that Germany's pain needed more than the death of a few Jews to alleviate it. It needed Germany to grow up. Beneath the slogan, he saw crudely daubed dribbles of red paint dripping from each hook, the sacred Teutonic firewhisk, the Hakenkreuz that every soldier in Colonel Erhard's 2nd Naval Freikorps Brigade had been forced to paint on their helmets when they had marched down to crush the feeble, self-styled Bavarian Soviet in the first week of May. It was the badge of every right-wing group in Germany. As the hammer and sickle to the Marxist, so the swastika to the nationalist. They had taken the place of the eagles as totems of allegiance. Sweating in the late September heat, Rudy turned into the maze of little medieval streets that led eastwards into the old town. The meeting, it seemed, was being held in the beer-serving back room of Sternecker's poky little brewery. Rudy's heart sank. From what he could remember of this room, it would be unlikely to hold more than 100. This evening was going to be a bore conducted in the hot, sweet stink of malt and brewer's yeast. There was an open book laid out on a small table by the door to the meeting room. What is this? Asked Gloder, with a disdainful wrinkle of the nostrils. Guest register, sir, said a ginger-headed, one-armed young man sitting at the table, nervously eyeing the metal ribbons on Rudy's coat. Rudy signed his name and underlined it with a flourish. Remind me of the name of this particular caucus, he said in a lazy drawl. Pan-German People's Party, National Workers' Party, German National Party, People's National Party, German, German, Pan-German, German Party. The young man flushed. The German Workers' Party, sir. Oh, yes, of course, murmured Rudy. How foolish of me. The young man looked at the signature and sprang to his feet. Forgive me, Herr Major, he said. Colonel Mayer told us to expect you at 7. I had thought, perhaps, you were not coming after all. Rudy sighed, straightened the coat across his back. The night was hot, but he enjoyed wearing a greatcoat over the shoulders, arrogant Prussian style, and followed the young man slowly into the room. The speaker is Herr Dietrich Feder, the young man whispered, before bowing and leaving the room. Rudy nodded, dusted the seat of a wooden chair with a flick of his glove, sat down, and looked lazily around him. There could not have been more than 40 or 50 men present, and a woman too, Rudy noticed. He thought he recognised her as the daughter of a district judge, pleasant, round breasts, but a most appalling, short-sighted, peering intensity. The gathering appeared to be giving Feder more attention than he deserved. Rudy knew him of old, a fanatic when it came to the subject of economics. He was peddling his bizarre concoction of warmed-over Marxism, served up with standard anti-trade unionism and Jew hatred. Really, listening to political speakers these days was like watching a cheap circus show of mutated freaks. Wonder at the leopard goat woman, thrill to the ape cat boy, gasp at the ambiguities of the Marxist anti-communist, marvel at the contortions of the pro-Weimar secessionist. There was a cheaply printed square of yellow paper on the floor, which Gloder picked up and studied. If this flyer were to be believed, he was listening to a talk entitled, How and by What Means Can One Abolish Capitalism? Rudy wondered idly if in fact this party, for all its right-wing paraphernalia and rhetoric, were not a cover for the Marxerei. There was no doubt that Moscow interested itself deeply in the internal politics of Germany. They were not above infiltrating even the smallest and meanest of political splinter groups. And look at how they had sent Bela Kuhn into Budapest with a cadre of commissars, a roll of money and instructions to report by radio to Lenin personally. Almost overnight, the Karolyi government had collapsed and Hungary had entered the Bolshevik fold. Europe was a rotting corpse, ripe for the communist carrion crow. Feder presented himself openly as a socialist, but a nationalist, anti-communist, anti-Semitic socialist. Was this a Bolshevik ploy, or was there perhaps some real point here? He spoke without guile or apparent political savvy, but there was something in this melange of ideas that appealed to Rudy. Feder was making a distinction between what he called good capitalism, the capitalism of mines, railways, factories and munitions, and bad capitalism, the capitalism of financial dealing houses, banks and credit institutions. In short, the capitalism of the German worker pitted against the capitalism of the Jew bloodsucker. Rudy made a series of notes with a silver-cased pencil in his slim black notebook. Investigate Dietrich Feder. Is he not the bee-in-law of historian Karl Alexander von Müller? Is he from same Feder family that worked for Prince Otto of Bavaria, later King of Greece? Known affiliations? Influence of Dietrich Eckart? He closed the notebook and listened with amusement as a new speaker arose, apparently Professor Baumann, who, after a few sentimental words of praise for Feder, had started to argue passionately that Bavaria should secede from Germany and form a Jew-free, Holy Catholic Union with Austria. Rudy had promised Meyer that he wouldn't speak, but this kind of nonsense could not go unchecked. He rose to his feet and cleared his throat. "Gentlemen, may I be permitted to speak?" he said, and was gratified to note that an immediate silence fell. Turning to the judge's daughter, he executed a small bow and clicked his heels with a polite, "Gnädiges Fräulein." It pleased him to see a small blush light up in the girl's pale cheeks. It came into his head as he walked into the centre of the room that her name was Rosa, Rosa Dernesch, and he congratulated himself on the smooth working of his mind, that a part of it could isolate such a small detail while the rest was preparing a public address. "Permit me to introduce myself," he said, smiling politely, as a rather confused Professor Baumann sat down, clearly with far more to say on the subject of Bavaria. "My name is Rudolf Gloder. You may see from this coat that I am an army major. I've been sent here to observe you by Colonel Meyer of the Bavarian Army Propaganda Unit. It is not in that capacity, however, that I wish to address you. So," he dropped his coat and officer's cap to the floor, "now it is not a soldier who speaks to you, but a German. A Bavarian, as it happens, but a German." Rudy paused and looked around the room, taking in the eyes of those who watched him. Some regarded him with distrust, others with contempt, a few with sympathy, and one or two with nodding approbation. He took a deep breath and then roared at the top of his voice, "Wake up! Wake up, you complacent fools! How dare you sit here and talk away the future of Germany? Wake up!" The volume of his voice startled everyone into shocked amazement, Rudy included. One old man in the corner had taken his words quite literally and woken up with a dribbling, coughing start and was now staring around in panic as if afraid that fire had broken out. Rudy pulled down his tunic and cleared his throat. A huge, buzzing bolt of energy, excitement and joy were surging through his body as if he had taken a great pinch of cocaine, as cavalry officers in the Habsburg regiments used to do before a charge. He was fully aware, as he spoke, of every detail of every face he looked into and felt a massive sense of power and ease. "Herr Fedder talks of the Jews in the banks and the Jews in Bolshevik Russia," he said in a quieter voice, almost a whisper, but one which he knew with confidence carried into every ear in the room. "He pours his scorn upon them with eloquence and with erudition. But I wonder how the Jews respond to this. Are they trembling in fear? Are they packing their bags to leave? Are they falling at our feet, craven with apology, and erupting with humble promises to mend their ways? No! They are laughing, my friends. They are laughing up their gabardine sleeves. And what has Professor Baumann, with all respect to that learned gentleman, what has he to say to this? He says Bavaria must leave Germany and join with Austria. Do I need to give you a history lesson? Do I need to remind you what we all heard on the 9th of May? Do I? Do I? Every German colony in Africa and the Pacific to be given up. No discussion, no appeal. 13% of German territory in Europe to be eaten up by other nations. Non-negotiable. Prussia cut in two by a corridor to the Baltic Sea. Danzig to be given to the Poles. No argument. 200,000 tons of shipping a year to be built in German yards and given to our conquerors. And money? How much money? A blank check. Reparations to be paid on a sliding scale. The more prosperous we become, the more we pay. Every drop of sweat that flies from the exhausted brow of every German worker is to join in the great torrent that will flow abroad to our enemies, while we struggle in our parched, desert of shame. All guilt, all blame for the war to be accepted by us, the German nation. Der Dolchstoß, it has been called, this dagger that the Hagens of Berlin have stuck into Siegfried's proud back with the help of Levier, Levinet, Hoffmann, Egelhofer, Luxembourg, Liebknecht, and the other Jews, communists and traitors. And what is Bauman's answer to this catastrophe? The greatest catastrophe that has faced any nation in the history of our earth? That Bavaria, proud Bavaria, should run cringing from under Germany's skirts and slip between the sheets with the barren, shriveled whore, Austria, while the Holy Father, like some overblown brothel keeper, looks on in glee and blesses the bastard issue of this harlotry, this craven fornication. That is a solution? That is realpolitik? Grow up! Grow up! And wake up! Our enemies are laughing and dancing in delight, even as we weep and thrash in our childish tantrums. Yet there is an answer to our ills. You won't like it, but it lies before us. There is one solution, one hope, one certain path to German pride and German survival. You know what it is. You all know what it is. It is the disbandment of parties like this. Wait! Before you tear me to pieces, before you howl me down as infiltrator, saboteur, agent provocateur and traitor, listen to what I have to say. It is one word. Exactly one word. The one word. The one word. The one word is unity. Yes! We can splinter ourselves into petulant little groups like this German Workers' Party of yours. We can refine and refine on political theory and economic theory and racial theory and national theory all we like and call ourselves clever and call ourselves patriots. We can sharpen our ideas until the razors of our minds are blunted. But the more we scrabble at straws, the more we howl at the moon, then the more our enemies gloat and giggle and grin. There are more than 50 separate political parties in Munich alone, most of them far larger than this one. Think about that. Think about that and weep. Look at Weimar, in their water-willed desperation to lick the arse of Woodrow Wilson. They have a government of such liberal benevolence, such magnanimity, that it too is comprised of dozens of different parties, each allowed a say in our national policy. Think about that and weep. But think now about one German party. Imagine such a thing. A single German party. For the single German worker, farmer, housewife, veteran, and child. A single German party that speaks with one single German voice. Think about that and laugh. For I tell you now, with all the power of prophecy and love of fatherland, I tell you now that such a party can rule not only Germany, but the whole earth. Shall I tell you how I know that I am right? There is an old rule of soldiering, of politics, of chess, of card play, of statecraft, of all sorts and forms of engagement. Do not do what you most want to do. Do only what your enemy would least like you to do. We know our enemies, the Bolshevik Jews, the financial Jews, the social democrats, the liberal intellectuals. What would they like us to do? They would like us to argue amongst ourselves as to who has the purest German soul, who has the best economic plan, who has the cleverest ideas, who speaks most for the average German. If we do that, they are happy, our enemies. The disaffected worker will find nothing in his politicians but schism and dissent. So he will join the Moscow-backed trade unions. The interest payments will keep rolling into the Jewish banks. Germany will still be in their grip. But what would our enemies least like us to do? To speak with one voice. To emerge as one German people in one party to control our own destiny. To look after our own workers. To develop our own engineering, science, and national genius to one aim, the emergence of Germany as a powerful modern state, dependent upon no one but its own people for its future. The Bolshevik Jew is denied influence. The financial Jew is shown the door. The liberal intellectual and the social democrat are shamed out of existence. All it takes is unity. Unity, unity, unity. But it will never happen, will it? It will never happen because we all want to be the king rooster of our own little dunghill. We will fail to do the one thing we need to do. Because it is hard. So hard. It will take patience and work and planning and sacrifice. It will take unity within to create unity without. It will take a massive effort of organization. I know the kind of unity the German is capable of. I have seen it and shared its sacred power in the trenches of Flanders. I know the kind of disunity the German is capable of. I'm looking at it now, in a smelly back room in Munich. Those are our choices. To divide and weep, or to unify and laugh. Myself? I'm a Bavarian. I love laughter. There. I've had my say. Forgive me. In recompense, allow me to buy a glass of beer for every man here. Rudy bent to pick up his greatcoat, threw it back over his shoulder, and returned to his seat. The silence before the ovation reminded him of the breath-held pause that followed the final notes of Götterdämmerung the first time he went with his father to the Bayreuth Festival. He had thought for a terrible moment that the audience had disapproved and that they were going to leave the theatre in silence. But then had come the applause. So it was now. A man, perhaps 10 years older than Rudy, pushed himself forward ahead of the others, extending a pink-jacketed pamphlet. "Herr Gloder!" he shouted above the cries of "Einheit! Einheit!" and the stamping of feet. "My name is Anton Drexler. I founded this party. We need you."
Modern History. Firestone. "I need you, Steve. You have to help me find a library." Steve dropped some dollar bills onto the beer-sodden table and hurried after me. "Jesus, man, what has gotten into you? Where's the nearest library? God's sake, this is Princeton. Any good one will do, please." "Okay, okay. There's the Firestone on campus, just across the street." "Come on, then." We ran past a post office, up the side of Palmer Square and into Nassau, across which I hurled myself without a sideways glance. "Heck, Mikey, you ever hear of jaywalking? I'm sorry, but I have to know." The Firestone Library was a gaunt stone cathedral of a building, crowned by a huge tower finned with sharp buttresses that launched up from the roof like a rocket.
I stood in the doorway and turned to Steve. "This has everything?" Steve shook his head with something approaching despair. "Mikey," he said, "there's over 11 million books on campus, and most of them are here." "And I'm allowed to use it?" He nodded with glum resignation and pushed open the door. "History," I hissed to him as we walked towards a massive central desk. "Where's modern European history?" "I think maybe we'd better reserve a Carrel," was his response.
"A what?"
"You know, a Carrel." I shook my head in puzzlement. "A room," said Steve irritably, plucking a white paper slip from the desk. "A private room for reading. A Carrel. What the hell else do you call them?" After half an hour's bureaucratic delay and whispered shelf raiding, we found ourselves in one of these Carrels, a small square room equipped with a desk, a chair, and handsome prints of 18th-century Princeton on the walls. On the table in front of me lay our hoard of 12 books. I sat down, picked up a Chronicle of World History, took a deep breath, and turned to H for Hitler. Nothing.
"You don't have to stay," I said to Steve over my shoulder.
"That's okay," said Steve, who was settling himself in the corner in a lotus position, a pictorial book of military history laid out from knee to knee. "Hey, I might even learn something." Maybe he did learn something. I was too engrossed to pay much attention. I turned to N for Nazi, and after staring for a while at this strange new name, to G for Gloder. My fingers scrabbled at the paper, peeling back page after page of the entry to see how much was given over to this one man. 70 pages, listed under different headings, each contributed by a different historian. The first entry pronounced itself to be a chronological biography. Gloder, Rudolf, 1894 to 1966, founder and leader of the Nazi Party, Reich Chancellor and guiding spirit of the Greater German Reich from 1928 until his overthrow in 1963. Head of state and supreme commander of the armed forces, Führer of the German peoples. Born Bayreuth, Bavaria, on 17th August 1894, the only son of a professional oboist and music teacher, Heinrich Gloder, QV, and his second wife, Paula von Meissner und Groth, QV, the young Rudolf was encouraged by his mother, who considered that she had married beneath herself, to believe that he came of aristocratic stock. Much has been written about Paula's connections with the German and Austrian aristocracy. See Gloder the Nobleman, A.L. Parlange, Louisiana State University Press, 1972, Prince Rudolf, Mouton and Grover, Tulane, 1982, etc. But there is little real evidence to show that his background was anything but that of a typical middle-class Bavarian family of the period. In later life, when ascending to power, Gloder went to great lengths to stress the ordinariness of his formative years, even hinting at years of poverty and hardship. But these claims bear as little inspection as his later claims of descendancy from a Habsburg line. As a child, there is no doubt that the young Rudolf was a considerable prodigy, proving himself an accomplished musician, equestrian, artist, athlete, and swordsman. He was able to read and write in four languages, as well as the obligatory Latin and Greek expected of any gymnasium student by the time he was 14. Such contemporary accounts as can be trusted show that he was popular with his schoolfellows and teachers, and the papers relating to his admission to the military academy at Munich in 1910, when he was 16, offer glowing testimonials to the high esteem in which he was held by all who knew him. At the outbreak of the Great War in 1914, Gloder joined the 16th Bavarian Infantry Reserve Regiment as an enlisted man, a decision which distressed his mother and puzzled many of his friends.
His own account of his wartime experiences, Kampfparolen, Munich 1923, Fighting Words, Trans Hugo Übermeyer, London 1924, a masterpiece of false modesty and glamorous self-romanticization, makes the claim that he wished to fight shoulder to shoulder with ordinary Germans. There can be no question, certainly, that had he joined as an officer in any of the smarter regiments, which would have welcomed a cadet of such impressive qualifications, he would never have been able to match the unexampled achievement of his giddy rise through the ranks from private Gemeiner to full staff major, collecting on the way, amongst other decorations, the Iron Cross First Class in the Oakleaf and Diamond Orders. I lowered the book for a moment and stared at the wall facing me. The 16th Bavarian Infantry Reserve. The regiment List. Hitler's regiment. The Germany to which Gloder returned late in 1918, following the signing of the 11th November armistice, was a nation in political uproar. Assigned the role of Vertrauensmann by Colonel Karl Mayer of the Bavarian Army Propaganda Unit, with a brief to keep an eye on the scores of burgeoning right- and left-wing political organizations springing up almost daily in the political vacuum left by Munich's abortive revolution of April 1919, Gloder attended, in the September of that year, a meeting of the fringe ultra-right faction, the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the German Workers' Party, led and founded by Anton Drexler, QV, a 36-year-old railway yard toolmaker. Although numbering fewer than 50 members, Gloder saw the DAP's apparently self-contradictory blend of anti-Marxist socialism and anti-capitalist nationalism as containing exactly the right ingredients for a party of national unity. Within 6 months, Gloder had cut off all official contact with the Reichswehr, resigned from Mayer's propaganda unit, joined the DAP, ousted the national chairman, a Thule Society agitator named Karl Harrer, QV, and elbowed aside Drexler himself to assume full leadership as Führer, or leader, of the party. In 1921, he added the prefix Nationalsozialistisch to the DAP's official title. Despite his loathing of socialism and labour unions, Gloder recognised the need for his party to attract ordinary working men who might otherwise be drawn into Marxism and Bolshevism. The NSDAP rapidly acquired, from the German pronunciation of the first four letters of its title, the universally applied sobriquet Nazi, claiming for its own the Hakenkreuz, or swastika, as its proprietary symbol, much to the disgust of other right-wing groups who had used it since the previous century in their literature and street banners. Gloder's greatest gifts in the early days of the party were of organisation and of demagoguery. Known for his ready, caustic wit, early rivals dismissed him as a comedian, but he was able to turn the unkindly meant nicknames of Gloder der ulkige Vogel or Rudi der Clown into weapons of rhetorical attack against his enemies. There is no question, however, that it was his charm that won him the most friends, and the steady stream of new recruits from all classes of society to the party that by the early 1920s had swelled to a flood. Naturally endowed with good looks, an athletic bearing, and a movie star smile, Gloder's ability to cultivate the admiration and trust of natural political enemies was legendary. The industrial and military classes had faith in him, the ordinary man admired and envied him, and women all over Germany and beyond openly worshipped him. Organisationally, he grouped the party into sections which were to deal with issues that he considered critical to the achievement of the growth of this fledgling party and the wider growth, when the time came, of Greater Germany herself. Propaganda was of huge importance, and the recruitment to the party of Joseph Goebbels, QV, an academic Rhinelander of strict Catholic upbringing who had been rejected for war service on account of a polio-crippled leg,
could not have been more timely. Goebbels' fear of being considered a bourgeois intellectual and his own sense of physical inferiority had led him to formulate a sentimental mythology of blonde Nordic purity and manly Spartan virtues. In Goebbels' eyes, Rudolf Gloder was the physical, spiritual, and intellectual embodiment of all these Aryan ideals, and from their first meeting, Goebbels' considerable gifts of oratory and his natural modern grasp of the techniques of newsreel and radio were placed entirely at his Führer's service. Propaganda was, for Gloder, the means to achieve and maintain political power. But over the years, he came to the view that an almost equal significance lay in the potential of science, engineering, and technological innovation. Swallowing his natural anti-Semitism, Gloder went out of his way to court the physicists of Göttingen University and other centres of scientific excellence, where developments in atomic and quantum physics were reaching far ahead of any comparable institutions outside Germany. It was Gloder's belief, prophetic as it turned out, that the good faith of the scientific community was essential for the future of Germany. This firmly held view ran counter to the instincts of ideologues such as Dietrich Eckhart, Alfred Rosenberg, and Julius Streicher, QQQV, and even his close friend Goebbels, who believed, with the others, that Jew science could only pollute a new Germany. Dietrich Eckhart, the title of whose poem Deutschland erwache became the first slogan of Nazism, had helped fund the purchase of the Völkischer Beobachter, the official newspaper of the NSDAP, but fell out with Gloder over what he now saw as his leader's soft-peddling tactics against the Jews, and the two never spoke again before Eckhart's death in 1923. At the time of Eckhart's funeral, Gloder complained to Goebbels that Eckhart never understood that to frighten the Jews away early would be a tactical error. Am Anfang, Rudolf Gloder, Berlin, 1932, My Early Life, Trans Gottlob Blumenbach, New York, 1933. Gloder would use anti-Semitism amongst the workers as a unifying slogan, but not at the expense of wasting the vital resources of Jewish science and banking. In secret meetings with the Jewish community throughout his early years, meetings of which even his most trusted allies were unaware, Gloder was able to convince prominent Jews that his party's anti-Semitism was public posture, and that Jews in Germany had less to fear from him than from the Marxists and other rightist factions. Gloder's third plank of policy in these early days was to organise an inner cadre under the ruthless leadership of Ernst Röhm, QV, which used violent techniques of street fighting and intimidation to frighten off opponents and to quell heckling and counter demonstrations from the left. Although these lawless squads of ex-servicemen and unemployed manual workers inspired fear and contempt in the liberal intellectuals of the time, Gloder managed privately to disavow and deprecate, to those who mattered, the brutal methods of his own party. He personally made friends with many writers, scientists, intellectuals, industrialists and jurists, for whom Nazism seemed anathema, apparently convincing them that the tactics of Röhm, the party's second-in-command, and Gloder's personally appointed deputy were a temporary expedient, a price worth paying for the defeat of communism. At the same time, Gloder travelled regularly and extensively, visiting France, Britain, Russia, and the United States, making great use of his linguistic gifts and charm of manner. Although during this period, 1922 to 1925, the Nazi Party had not run in a single election, it had grown within 4 years to become, after the Social Democrats, QV, and Communists, the third largest party in Germany and a real force to be reckoned with. Gloder's journeys abroad, in his famous red Fokker airplane, trading none too subtly on the universally respected image of Baron von Richthofen, with whom he also later claimed kinship, were designed to demonstrate to the world, and to Germans back home, that he was a reasonable, civilized man, a man of culture and statecraft, who cut a credible figure on the world stage. He explained to those foreign politicians who would receive him, and there were many, that he could not put his party up for election until he was able to ameliorate the terms of the Versailles Treaty, QV. In this way, he outflanked the Social Democrats, forged links with power brokers in Europe and America, and made a name for himself in the international arena at a time when Germany was an almost entirely inward-looking nation, still dealing with the shame of military defeat and the humiliation of the enforced peace. During these years of travel, Gloder appeared in a Hollywood silent picture, guying his own reputation for oratory and wit. The Public Speaker, Hal Roach, 1924, played golf with the Prince of Wales, QV, danced with Josephine Baker, QV, climbed the Matterhorn, and forged many friendships and alliances which were to prove crucial in the years to come. In 1923, Gloder repelled the advances of Erich Ludendorff, whose dreams of power encompassed the dismantling of the Weimar Republic, QV, and the installation of a military-style junta in its place. Ludendorff had attempted to seize power once before in Berlin during the abortive Kapp Putsch of 1920, and Gloder distrusted the veteran general's political judgment. He distrusted even more the extreme forms of paranoia against Freemasonry, Jesuitism and Judaism exhibited by Ludendorff's insistence that supranational powers had caused the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, QV, in Sarajevo, as well as the military defeat of Germany in 1918. The general had even gone so far as to claim that both Mozart and Schiller had been murdered by the Grand Cheka of the supranational secret society. Gloder gave orders that no Nazi should assist Ludendorff in this new attempt to take the reins of power. And it is probable he tipped off the Weimar authorities in November when, at the head of an army of barely 200, Ludendorff rode into the centre of Munich from the Bürgerbräukeller to be summarily arrested on a charge of treason. The ability on the part of Gloder to wait for the right moment was best tested 5 years later in 1928, when he once more refused to allow the NSDAP to run in the national elections. He persuaded the upper echelons of his party that they could not expect to win such an election, and that even were they to do so, the economic conditions were not propitious. An element of prosperity was entering German life, and the Social Democrats were riding high in public opinion. It was far better to exercise patience and to wait. A few months later, the Wall Street crash, QV, and the onset of the Great Depression, QV, was to prove the acumen of this political judgment. Hjalmar Schacht, Fritz Thyssen, Gustav Krupp, Friedrich Flick, QQQQV, and other wealthy German industrial magnates quickly gauged the incompetence of the Social Democrats in the face of this unprecedented world slump and began to pour